Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 104.
Well, we're diving into Chapter 104 of the classic Dream of the Red Chamber. And it's a profoundly disorienting place to stand.
Because it exposes the rot at, like, every single level, right?
Exactly. It exposes the structural rot at every layer of human existence simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
To navigate this, we're tracking five key figures from the text.
And they basically map out the entire social hierarchy, don't they?
They do. First, we have Jia Yukun, who is this highly ambitious, very morally flexible government official.
He's sort of the brutal machinery of the state.
Right. Then we have Jia Zhang, the rigid, traditional patriarch of the massive Jia family. He's just coming back from a political demotion.
Coming home to a house he doesn't even recognize.
Yeah, exactly. Then there's Jia Yun, a struggling, poor relative of the main family. He's desperately trying to manipulate his fading bloodline prestige.
And down in the dirt, we have our drunk guy.
Right, this street-tough character known as Drunken Vajra Nir. And finally, trapped inside the family's crumbling emotional core, we have Bao Yu.
The sensitive, grieving romantic.
Exactly.
So let's examine the mechanics of how this power structure begins to fracture. And I want to start right down in the dirt with that street brawl.
It's such a great scene.
It really is. We have this ambitious official, Jia Yukun, making his way toward the capital in his sedan chair.
Which, we should point out, isn't just transportation.
Right. No, it's the physical projection of state power. He's got this massive entourage, guards clearing the road. He expects absolute compliance from everyone.
And then the whole procession just stops.
Stops completely, just because of one intoxicated man.
Yi'er, the drunken Vajra. He literally just blocks the path of this official's entourage.
And when the guards tell him to move, he just lies down right in the middle of the street.
His legal defense here is just a fascinating paradox.
Oh, I love this part. Tell him what he says.
He looks at the armed guards and says, "I bought my alcohol with my own money, and now that I'm drunk, I am lying on the emperor's ground."
The emperor's ground?
Right. He says, "Even your great official has no jurisdiction over me here."
I really want to dissect the specific logic he's using there, because Nier is a street thug, right?
Yeah, an enforcer of sorts.
But he intuitively weaponizes this major loophole in the political philosophy of absolute monarchy.
The overarching theory of Qianxia.
Exactly. All under heaven belongs to the emperor. So by claiming the literal dirt beneath him belongs exclusively to the sovereign, he's totally bypassing Yukun.
He's bypassing the localized bureaucratic authority completely.
Yeah. He's exposing the fragile middle layer of the imperial administration.
Because the emperor obviously can't be everywhere at once. So he delegates authority to officials like Yukun.
Right.
But Yukun's essentially arguing for a direct-to-consumer relationship with the sovereign.
I love that analogy, a direct-to-consumer model for imperial loyalty.
That's exactly what it is. He's saying that between the dirt he sleeps on and the absolute top of the pyramid, Yukun is just an unauthorized middleman.
Which is such a direct challenge to the whole proxy system that keeps the empire running.
Right, because if every citizen claims direct allegiance only to the emperor and ignores the magistrates, the state collapses.
And Yukun clearly recognizes the danger of that philosophy because he doesn't entertain it for a single second.
Oh, not at all. He immediately orders his guards to beat Nuherkar right there in the dirt.
He uses physical violence to reassert that middleman authority. He even mocks him, right?
Yeah, he mocks the nickname, saying, "Let's see if he's really a Vajra," which is a reference to indestructible Buddhist guardian figures.
So they whip him, arrest him, and drag him off to jail. And you can just go to his office to report for duty completely unbothered.
Like it was nothing.
Exactly. But this routine exercise of state violence triggers a massive crisis for Nair's family.
And this is where we see the secondary, unofficial system of power exposed.
The favor economy.
Right. When Nair's wife and daughter find out he's locked up, they don't seek legal counsel.
Obviously not.
They go to the gambling dens, which maps out his social ecosystem. And they're advised to leverage a completely different kind of currency.
Yeah. The locals tell the daughter that Lord Yukun is politically connected to the massive Rongo mansion.
And conveniently, her father is owed a favor by Jia Yun, who is a peripheral member of that exact family.
So let's map out how this favor economy actually functions. It's not just a casual network, is it?
No. Not at all. It acts as a rigid, parallel legal system. Formal law is brutal and arbitrary, like we just saw with the whipping.
Right, so survival depends on Guangxi.
Exactly. A deeply ingrained system of social networks and reciprocal obligations.
Because Jia Yun previously borrowed money from Ni'er when he was desperate.
Which created a quantifiable debt in the favor economy.
Right, so when Ni's family comes to collect, Jia Yun acts like discharging this debt requires zero effort.
He's so arrogant about it. He promises he'll just walk over to the West Mansion, say the word, and Yukon will release Ni'er.
Just because Yukon owes his own career to the Jia family's influence.
Ji Yuyun is attempting to trade on the macro-level prestige of his surname.
He assumes that just being blood-adjacent to the central family gives him unlimited access to their political capital.
He views their influence as a shared communal resource, something he can just draw upon to settle his street debts.
But the reality of how power works inside that massive family is way more restrictive.
Oh, absolutely.
He goes to the Grand Runglo Mansion to withdraw this political capital, and the system completely locks him out.
He approaches the front gate, and the gatekeepers, who are legally classified as servants, by the way, completely ignore him.
And the text gives us the mechanical reason for this, right?
Previously, Jia Yun tried to offer a gift to the powerful female manager of the inner household, Wang Shifen, and she rejected it.
That rejection is such a critical data point.
It really is. In these highly stratified aristocratic households, gatekeepers don't grant access just based on bloodline.
Right. They operate more like localized risk assessment algorithms.
They constantly monitor the internal political market of the household.
So the moment Wang Shifeng rejected his gift, his stock price basically plummeted to zero.
Exactly. The servants realized he possessed no active utility or favor with the core power brokers.
So extending him courtesy offers no return on investment for them.
It actually risks aligning them with an out-of-favor relative, which is dangerous for them.
It's like a failing smart contract in a decentralized system. The authorization protocol isn't checking his identity. It knows his name is Jia.
Right.
It's checking his current transactional value in the network ledger.
That's a perfect way to put it. Because the central node, Wang Shifeng, flagged the transaction as rejected, the perimeter nodes, the gatekeepers, automatically deny access.
You can't even get them to announce him. And he's terrified to ask for other family members because he doesn't want to annoy the servants.
He tries to go around the firewall by going to the back garden to find Bayou, but the physical gate is locked.
The system just walled him off entirely. It's crazy.
It reveals a profound structural vulnerability in the Jia clan. They aren't a cohesive unit anymore.
The wealthy core has completely isolated itself.
Behind all these administrative layers, yeah. They've alienated the broader network of relatives.
So you have a family where a blood relative literally holds less practical authority than a hired gatekeeper.
When that happens, the family ceases to function as a mutual defense network. It becomes a fortress, slowly starving its own outer settlements.
Wow. And we have to examine Jia Yun's reaction to this because his next move is the catalyst for the entire disaster.
He has a choice to make.
Right. He can return to Ni'er's family and admit he has zero influence, or he can fabricate a narrative.
And he chooses the lie.
He tells Ni'er's family, I went, I spoke to the family, but Lord Yukon simply refused to listen to us.
He constructs this reality where he possesses the access he claimed, but the higher authorities maliciously deny the request.
It's an aggressive preservation of Mianzi, or face.
Right. To admit to the street-level actors that mere servants rebuffed him would annihilate his social capital permanently.
So the lie preserves his status as a player. But the systemic cost of that lie is astronomical.
Because by claiming he delivered the message and it was rejected, he redirects all of Ni'er's impending wrath directly onto the Jia family.
Exactly. But wait, let's test his motivation here. Is Jia Yun just a fragile narcissist protecting his ego, or is this a calculated survival mechanism?
Well, what do you think?
I mean, in this society, if a peripheral figure like him loses his perceived connection to the central power, does he lose his physical safety on the streets?
It is absolutely a survival mechanism, which makes it all the more tragic.
Without the perceived backing of the mansion, he's just another vulnerable citizen.
Vulnerable to the exact kind of arbitrary violence Ni'er just suffered, his illusion of power is his only armor.
But in deploying that armor, he weaponizes a highly dangerous man.
Because Ni'er's family eventually uses a different node in the favor network to secure his release.
Mm-hmm.
They absorb a few more lashes, but he gets out.
And when Ni'er gets home, he's fed Jia Yun's fake story that the great Jia family actively chose to leave him rotting in a cell.
And Ni'er doesn't just get angry. he organizes a targeted, systemic retaliation.
Yeah, he spent his time in the cells networking with the underworld, gathering intelligence.
He discovers the Gia family's corruption isn't just in the capital. They have distant relatives and rogue servants out in the provinces operating like violent cartels.
So Nair lays out this specific blackmail strategy to his wife.
Right. He plans to mobilize his gambling den associates to publicly expose the Gia family's systemic, usury, illegal, high-interest lending.
And their practice of forcefully abducting the wives and daughters of commoners, he even names a specific victim, right?
Yes. A man named Little Zhang, whose wife was stolen by the Gia network.
So Nair's threat is a catastrophic breach in the Gia family's security protocol.
Because they rely on a monopoly of violence and legal immunity. But Nair intends to use public exposure to force the imperial legal system to act against them.
He's taking local street-level data and escalating it to a national scandal.
The threat from the dirt is fully active.
But the narrative architecture of the text does something brilliant here. It suspends that street-level threat and rewinds the timeline just slightly.
Back to the moment right before Gia Yukon arrived at that intersection.
Exactly. We move away from the gritty street blackmail, and suddenly we confront this bizarre supernatural anomaly.
This transition forces us to evaluate the metaphysical reality alongside the political reality.
Yeah, so before Yukon encounters Nair, he departs from a rural temple where he'd been talking with an old Taoist priest named Zen Xin.
And shortly after leaving, Yukon's servant sprints up to the sedan chair to report that the very temple they just exited has violently erupted into flames.
And Yukon is presented with a critical decision point.
The servant describes roaring fire and choking ash.
Yukon does this really cold internal calculus. He wonders if the old priest is trapped in the inferno, but he explicitly chooses not to turn the procession around.
The text notes his internal justification here. Turning back would delay his journey to the capital.
Right. It would interrupt his bureaucratic momentum and stall his career.
He identifies himself fundamentally as a man concerned with fame and fortune.
That self-identification is just the core of his psychology.
Fame and fortune requires perpetual forward motion in the material world. To halt the procession to save a human life is an inefficient allocation of resources.
Wow. So he just orders the servant to stay behind, wait for the fire to go out, count the bodies, and report back later.
And Yukon simply continues his journey toward the capital, prioritizing abstract career concepts over a burning building.
But when that servant finally catches up to Yukon the next day, the data he delivers completely breaks the laws of physical reality.
It's a surreal moment. The servant reports that after the structure collapsed and cooled, he searched the epicenter of the fire.
The old priest was gone, but there were no charred remains, no bones.
Nothing.
Instead, resting perfectly intact in the dead center of the devastation, the servant found the priest's woven sitting mat, completely unburned.
Alongside a wooden gourd. The imagery here is deeply rooted in Taoist philosophy.
Right. The untouched mat signifies what exactly?
It signifies a state of perfect stillness and detachment from the destructive cycles of the material world.
And the gourd.
It's a classic Taoist symbol, representing a vessel that contains the cosmos. Or a symbol of emptiness that holds true spiritual substance.
But the physical mechanics of what happens next are just terrifying. The servant explains that he tried to pick up the mat and the gourd to show Yukon.
But the exact millisecond his worldly hand made contact with the objects, they instantly disintegrated into ash.
They just collapsed into dust upon contact with a representative of the imperial bureaucracy.
It's a profound thermodynamic metaphor for societal collapse.
Oh, I love that. Unpack that a bit.
The sudden disintegration demonstrates the absolute incompatibility between spiritual transcendence and material ambition.
The universe is giving Yukon an undeniable physical demonstration that his world, the world of ranks and titles, is fundamentally an illusion.
Right. It's ash waiting to scatter. The moment the grasping hand of the state attempts to possess the spiritual artifact, it ceases to exist.
I just struggle to see how a hyper-rational bureaucrat like Yukon even processes that data.
It's definitely a system shock.
It completely invalidates the foundational logic of his entire life. It's like a localized data caching system suddenly failing to sync, revealing the database is empty code.
He is literally staring into the void.
Exactly. So how does he react?
Well, the text is clear on his internal processing. He doesn't dismiss the servant as a liar.
He actually acknowledges the reality of it internally.
Yes. He secretly realizes that the priest didn't die, but has achieved Kisin Shu's. He has shed his mortal coil and become an immortal.
He accepts the supernatural reality, But then his next action defines the total tragedy of his character.
He immediately buries the data.
He goes home to his wife, who is having a very normal human empathetic reaction. She's distraught, feeling guilty they didn't save the old man.
She assumes they're responsible for his painful death.
And Yukon, looking right at her grief, chooses to fabricate this totally sterile reality.
He tells her, don't worry, there were no remains, because the old man simply woke up early and left before the fire started.
He constructs a narrative firewall
to protect his domestic tranquility, but more importantly, his own ideological framework.
Right, because if he articulates the truth of the miracle aloud, he gives it shape and power.
By reducing a supernatural disintegration into a mundane story about a guy checking out of a hotel early, he domesticates the terror of the infinite.
Let's examine the psychology of that lie, because it perfectly mirrors Jia Yun's lie at the gate. Right.
They're very similar coping mechanisms.
Is Yukon operating as a pure sociopath here, casually deleting facts? Or is this a manifestation of profound existential terror?
Oh, it is absolutely driven by terror. The cognitive dissonance is lethal.
Right, because if he acknowledges the material world is just fragile ash, he'd have a total psychological collapse.
Exactly. He's an intellectually brilliant man. He knows he just ordered a man beaten in the streets to assert his authority.
If he integrates the knowledge that his authority is an illusion, the moral weight of his violence becomes unjustifiable.
He's trapped in the momentum of his own ambition. He can't stop the sedan chair, figuratively speaking.
Because stopping means admitting the journey is pointless. So he chooses the brutal, tactile reality of the machine over the terrifying liberation of the ashes.
And his desperate commitment to that machine brings us seamlessly to the apex of the imperial hierarchy,
where we see exactly how lethal that machine can be.
We shift focus to Jia Zheng, the rigid patriarch of the central family,
who is currently experiencing the absolute peak of worldly terror.
He's just returned to the capital from his provincial demotion.
And instead of a quiet resumption of duties, he gets summoned to a private audience with the emperor.
Now, to understand his physiological reaction to this meeting, we have to understand the architecture of imperial power.
The emperor doesn't summon a demoted official for a casual chat.
No. The audience chamber is designed to strip the individual of all power, reducing them to absolute submission before the mandate of heaven.
And when Jia Zheng comes out of this meeting, his biological response tells the whole story.
He is sweating so profusely, he looks physically ill.
He openly tells his peers, I was scared to death. And the data he relays proves his fear is totally justified.
Because the emperor bypassed all standard administrative pleasantries.
He immediately interrogated him on specific, highly localized criminal activities occurring in distant provinces.
The intelligence the emperor possesses here is terrifyingly precise.
Right. He asks about weapon smuggling and then heavily focuses on reports that family servants are operating extortion rackets.
And forcefully abducting the wives and daughters of commoners.
We have to pause and connect the nodes here because this narrative engineering is just spectacular.
It's all tying together.
The emperor of the known world is interrogating the highest patriarch of the Jia family about stealing commoner women.
Which is the exact specific crime that Nair, the drunken street enforcer, is currently mobilizing the underworld to expose regarding Little Zhang.
It's a perfectly synchronized pincer movement of doom.
The threat is escalating simultaneously from the absolute lowest dirt and the highest pinnacle of the throne.
The Jia family thinks they're insulated by bureaucracy, but the top and bottom of the hierarchy independently identify the exact same structural vulnerability.
And the emperor uses a specific psychological weapon during the interrogation, naming names.
Jia Zheng tells his allies the emperor specifically asked about two people.
The first was Jia Hua, which is the formal registry name of Jia Yukun.
And the second was this obscure, distant relative named Jia Fan.
Jia's gang is forced to kneel on the floor, sweating through his robes, and confirm that Jia Fan is indeed a member of their extended clan.
And the emperor's response is just a masterclass in legal terror.
He says, even if it is merely your family's servants forcefully taking the wives and daughters of good citizens, do you believe you can still evade the consequences?
The emperor is invoking collective family responsibility here, right?
Yes. The little doctrine of Zulian.
In an empire without modern surveillance, the state uses the family unit as the primary mechanism of law enforcement.
The patriarch is legally liable for the actions of every member of the bloodline and their registered servants,
regardless of geographic distance or actual knowledge of the crime.
Exactly.
It's like a massive high-risk franchise liability model. You're the CEO in the capital, licensing the Jia brand to local managers across the continent.
And suddenly, the primary regulator pulls you into a windowless room.
And tells you a rogue franchise 3,000 miles away is running an extortion ring using your branded trucks.
And because your name is on the charter, you and your family will be executed for their crimes.
You have zero operational control over that servant, but you carry 100% of the mortal liability.
That analogy captures the systemic paranoia of the aristocracy perfectly.
The sheer vastness of their influence is their fatal flaw. They've expanded beyond their capacity to audit their own nodes.
The allied officials try to calm Jia Zhang down using statistical logic.
They argue that the dynasty is old, the name Jia is common, and the emperor is just sorting through bureaucratic noise.
True is true, false is false, they say, trying to rely on an objective legal standard.
But Jia Zhang dismisses their optimism because he understands the political reality beneath the legal framework.
He tells them the emperor is keeping a close eye on the name Jia. That alone is the danger.
Let's interrogate the emperor's true motive here. Is he genuinely concerned about the moral violation of little Zhang losing his wife?
Is he a righteous regulator trying to clean up local corruption?
Right, or is he just weaponizing these reports to manufacture legal leverage against an aristocratic bloc that got too powerful?
It is almost entirely a mechanism for the consolidation of central power.
The emperor doesn't care about little Zhang.
Not really, no. The existential threat to an absolute monarch is a unified, wealthy aristocracy that thinks it's above the law.
So the emperor cares that the Jia family's localized monopolies on violence challenge the state's total monopoly on violence.
By memorizing the names of obscure relatives, the emperor is signaling that he's already compiled the dossier.
He's just waiting for the optimal political moment to execute the purge. The crimes of the servants are just the key to unlock the executioner's block.
Carrying that crushing weight, Jia Zhang leaves the court and travels back to his own estate.
And this transition exposes the lethal disconnect between the external political reality and the internal domestic fiction.
He arrives at the Grand Rongguo Mansion, and the contrast between the terror he just survived and the artificial serenity of his home is staggering.
We enter the realm of institutionalized willful blindness.
Jia Zhang's first duty is to report to the Supreme Matriarch, Jia Mother.
He delivers this completely sanitized intelligence briefing. He says his daughter, Tanshan, married off to a frontier territory, is theoretically doing well.
He casually mentions rumors of border skirmishes or oceanic conflicts, framing geopolitical instability as a minor weather report.
Rather than a systemic threat to his daughter's survival, then he shifts focus to evaluating the younger generation of males.
The ones supposed to inherit this crumbling empire.
And his diagnostic criteria are entirely divorced from reality. He observes Bao Yu, our sensitive protagonist.
Who, unbeknownst to Jia Zhang, has recently suffered a catastrophic psychological trauma.
Right. But Jia Zhang looks at Baoyu's catatonic, deadened demeanor and concludes, his face looks a bit fuller. He is acting very quiet. This is good. He is finally maturing.
Jia Zhang's diagnostic failure highlights the core defect of patriarchal authority systems.
Because he demands absolute obedience, he interprets the complete shutdown of Baoyu's emotional operating system as successful compliance.
Silence is interpreted as stability.
He praises his grandson Lan's elegance, maintains his disdain for his son Huan. He surveys a fundamentally broken house and declares it structurally sound.
But the reason his diagnostic process fails so spectacularly is because the data is actively manipulated by middle management.
His wife, Wang Lady, engages in a massive cover-up.
While he was away, the family engineered a deceptive marriage plot that directly resulted in the death of Baiyu's true love, Dai Yu.
A seismic, traumatic event that ripped the soul out of the household. And Wang Lady actively suppresses this intelligence.
She hides Dai Yu's death entirely to avoid ruining his happy return.
Wang Lady's decision is a masterclass in managing the optics of power.
It mirrors the gatekeepers hiding reality from Jia Yun and Yukin hiding the ashes from wife.
The whole social architecture is designed to insulate the apex authority from negative data.
Because in a strict hierarchy, delivering bad news to the patriarch is dangerous.
No.
It disrupts harmony, which is seen as a moral failure of the manager.
It's the architectural equivalent of a building manager discovering the load-bearing walls are consumed by termites.
And deciding to just apply a fresh coat of high-gloss paint to the lobby.
Exactly. The safety inspector, Jia Zhang, walks in, feels the smooth paint, signs off on the stability, and goes to sleep in the penthouse while the steel warps beneath him.
And even when anomalies pierce the facade, the response is entirely performative.
Eventually, Wang Lady casually mentions Dayu's death as an afterthought, which does cause Jia Xing to weep, showing a flash of genuine humanity.
They also briefly acknowledge that two allied political powerhouses, Wang Zetang and Xu Pan, collapsed due to corruption.
The data points of systemic failure are laid out right in front of him, but his corrective action is completely hollow.
The next day, he summons his nephews, Jia Zhen and Jia Lian.
He essentially gives them a verbal warning. I've heard external rumors you are misbehaving. You need to be careful.
The nephews blush, offer the required verbal submission, and immediately leave.
He initiates zero audits, implements no new oversight protocols.
He treats systemic corruption as a minor behavioral infraction, corrected with a brief reprimand.
The system prioritizes the performance of authority over the actual exercise of it. He checked the administrative box.
Thereby absolving himself of responsibility without doing the messy work of dismantling their criminal operations.
Let's test Wang Lady's original decision to withhold the data about Dayu's death. I want to examine the emotional mechanics there.
Okay, what are you thinking?
Is it possible she's operating out of genuine spousal empathy? The man just returned from a brutal demotion. He almost had a heart attack in front of the emperor.
Is she just trying to give him one peaceful evening?
Right. Or is her suppression of the truth a calculated administrative move? Because acknowledging the death forces the family to confront their culpability.
It leans heavily toward administrative self-preservation.
Even with some baseline spousal care mixed in.
Yes. Because the death of Dayu isn't just a tragedy, it's a political failure.
The elders manipulated Baiyu's marriage to Bao Chai, using deception that shattered Dayu's will to live.
If Wang Lady officially reports this death immediately, it requires an immediate autopsy of the decision-making process that led to it.
So by delaying the data and presenting it later as an unavoidable tragedy, she neutralizes the volatility of the information.
She manages the crisis by quietly burying it under the routine of the household.
Which forces us to leave the curated, painted lobby of the patriarch's reality and descend into the absolute wreckage of the foundation.
We transition away from the adults managing optics and enter the psychological reality of the boy they believe is maturing.
We are looking at the geography of Baiyu's grief.
Once the performative family dinner concludes and Jia Zhang exits Baiyu's quarters, the facade instantly evaporates.
The narrative drops us directly into Baiyu's agonizing, sleepless night. He is now married to Bao Chai.
Orchestrated by the very elders who just smiled at dinner.
His first action is to ask Bao Chai to go to sleep before him, claiming he needs to steady his mind.
He requires her physical absence just to regulate his breathing.
When she's asleep, he turns to his loyal maid, Zhiren, and just begins to unravel.
He begs her to secretly fetch Ziyuan, who was the fiercely protective maid of the deceased Dayu.
Because Baoyu is operating in an absolute data vacuum regarding the most important event of his life.
He desperately needs to interrogate Ziyuan to reconstruct Dayu's final moments.
He zeroes in on one agonizing variable. Does she hate him when she died?
He's attempting to debug a corrupted emotional narrative.
Because of the elders' deception, Dayu died under the false impression that Baiyu had willingly betrayed her.
Baiyu explicitly articulates his entrapment, stating his anguish over being recorded in history as a heartless man.
He tells Yurin, "This marriage is not what I wanted. The elders played a trick on me, and now I am the villain."
He's trapped inside a narrative architecture designed by his family and lacks the authority to rewrite the code.
And this structural entrapment triggers a catastrophic failure in his primary coping mechanism, his art.
Baiyu usually processes external trauma through the creation of poetry.
He remembers a previous tragedy, the death of a favored rebellious maid named King Wen.
When she died, he was able to marshal his intellectual resources and compose a beautiful, massive elegy.
But now, facing the death of Dayu, the center of his emotional universe, he tells Zhiren he has no inspiration.
His linguistic processing is completely shut down.
The mechanical difference between those two deaths explains the writer's block, doesn't it?
Completely. The death of the maid, King Wen, while tragic, still fit within the established parameters of their societal matrix.
Masters punish maids. Maids die. It's harsh but comprehensible.
Therefore, Baoyu could use the structure of language to build a memorial for her.
But the death of Dayu is the structural collapse of the matrix itself. Language requires an agreed-upon reality to function.
Exactly. An elegy requires narrative cohesion, a beginning, middle, and an accepted end.
But Baoyu cannot accept the end because the causality is built on a lie.
His guilt, the systemic betrayal by his parents, the fundamental injustice of her despair, it short-circuits his ability to construct meaning.
His inability to write isn't just a lack of vocabulary. It is the total systemic failure of his internal world.
He can't mourn her properly, because to mourn her is to accept a reality that he finds fundamentally uninhabitable.
So because the physical reality of her death is too toxic to process, his mind initiates a radical override.
He begins to speculate, utilizing the mystical parameters of their universe.
He tells his maid, "I saw her coffin, but I do not believe she is in there."
He pieces together circumstantial anomalies. The fact that Dai Yu burned all her poetry before dying, erasing her intellectual footprint.
And rumors among the servants of heavenly music playing at the moment of her passing.
From this data, he constructs a hypothesis. Dai Yu did not die in the biological sense. She transcended.
He speculates she shed her physical form and returned to the realm of immortals as a deity.
This is where the structural brilliance of the novel's architecture reveals itself.
Yes. We have to connect Bao Yu's hypothesis directly back to Jia Yukun's encounter in the burned temple.
Bao Yu hypothesizing that Dai Yu's physical body vanished to escape the material world is the exact same supernatural evasion mechanism Yukun witnessed with the Taoist priest's ashes.
It is the identical phenomenon processed by two entirely different operating systems.
We have Yukun, the cynical, hyper-rational agent of the state, who is presented with physical proof of the spiritual void.
The disintegrating gourd. And he actively chooses to suppress it so he can continue acquiring power.
And on the other end, we have Bao Yu, the pure, powerless romantic.
Who is crushed by the acquisition of power around him, desperately inventing the spiritual void as a psychological escape hatch.
Yukun rejects the miracle because it threatens his reality. Bao Yu demands the miracle because his reality is already destroyed.
The material world is closing in on both of them. For Yukun, it's the emperor's impending wrath.
For Bao Yu, it's the suffocating walls of his arranged marriage.
The only viable exit strategy presented by the universe is the complete dissolution of the physical self.
Let's test the nature of Bao Yu's hypothesis.
Yeah, given that this narrative universe objectively contains supernatural elements, is Bao Yu engaging in genuine theological deduction?
Or is this purely a psychological dissociation protocol?
Is the biological reality of the girl he loves decomposing inside a sealed wooden box simply too much cognitive load for his traumatized brain?
Forcing his mind to invent a divine ascension to prevent a total psychological shutdown.
I mean, it functions as both within the text, right?
It does. But the immediate tactile reality is psychological dissociation. He cannot alter the political machinery of his family that put her in that box.
He cannot reverse the biological cessation of her heart.
The denial of the physical corpse is the final, desperate defense mechanism of a mind under siege.
He can't fix the broken world, so he edits the data to suggest she simply logged out of it.
And the physical world of the Jia family is indeed powering down. The source text concludes this sequence with a subtle yet devastating logistical detail.
The family had originally scheduled a massive, spectacular theatrical play to celebrate Jia Xing's return.
To project an image of enduring power to the capital.
But silently, without fanfare, the administration cancels the spectacle.
They downgrade the event to a quiet, subdued wine gathering with a few close associates in a back room.
The grand performance of the dynasty is over. The energy is bleeding out of the system.
The machinery is still physically standing, but the power source has been severed. They're just waiting for the inertia to run out. ¶¶